On behalf of the Center for Jewish Studies, I'd like to welcome everyone here. My name is Bill Schneiderman. I'm the chair of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department at UCLA, which is where the Jewish Studies major is housed. I'm also on the steering committee for the Center for Jewish Studies, and our department, together with the Center for Jewish Studies, has been sponsoring this lecture series on the Bible and its interpreters every winter quarter for, I should say, as long as I can remember. But if I say that, what it really means is that I'm getting old and my memory is fading. It's probably been at least four or five years, though, that we've been doing this lecture series. This is the first of the lectures this quarter, the first by Professor Smoak. We have flyers for the events for the Center for Jewish Studies on the table, and a sign up if you want to know about all the many things that are going on in the Center for Jewish Studies. Please, you know, go to the table, sign up, grab some flyers, come by and visit. I just want to remind you of two other lectures. The next week we're going to have the second lecture in the series. It will be Dr. Mark Smith from NYU, who's going to be speaking on the three bodies of God in the Hebrew Bible. And then I especially want to remind you about the lecture on Tuesday, February 16th, where Dr. Ava Mrocek will be coming. Her lecture was originally scheduled, I think, for the 23rd, and she had a problem, and we had to reschedule it for February 16th. So some of you might have had it on your calendars for the 23rd. It's been rescheduled for February 16th. I'll remind you again next week. But she's coming, and she's going to be speaking on Imagining Scripture Before the Bible, Shapes of Sacred Writing in Early Judaism. This is the topic of her new book. I'm especially pleased today to be able to introduce Dr. Jeremy Smoak. Now, I have to admit that I don't have a bio today, so this is going to be hard to introduce Dr. Smoak without knowing too much about him. But since he did do his PhD at UCLA under my supervision, I should be able to handle this. But you know, the problem is that he's been so active in the last couple of years that I just don't know if I know all the details correct. So please correct me when I if I'm forgetting things. Dr. Smoak has been teaching for us at UCLA for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm really happy to say that he's been a real boon to the Jewish Studies program. The numbers of students in the classes that he is teaching have really grown, and it's the enrollments in our Jewish Studies major and minor, and so, you know, from that perspective, he's been fantastic. But he's also a really outstanding scholar. This is actually, I don't know whether to call this his first book or his second book. It's kind of more, you know, it's kind of a liminal in that sense. It's called The Priestly Blessing in Scripture and Inscription. It just appeared with Oxford University Press this year. This is not his dissertation. This is a second book on one of the most important archaeological finds of the last generation, which is the silver amulets from Ketephanom. His first book, actually, what I would call his first book, is going to come out sometime in June or July or the summer with Moore Seebeck, which is actually a revision of his doctoral dissertation. So he's already on his second book before his first book, which I think itself is a major accomplishment. He has a third book coming out, hopefully by the end of this year, from Rutledge, on the religion of ancient Israel, which is also a really interesting topic. It's a class that he and I have both taught at UCLA, and a topic that hasn't been well addressed in textbooks, so I'm looking forward to that coming out as well this year. So it's going to be an epic year for Dr. Smoak, and he's starting off this year with this presentation to you, and I'd just like everyone to welcome Dr. Jeremy Smoak.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the very kind introduction. I'm sure overstated in ways. But let me first thank the Center for Jewish Studies for inviting me to give the talk today. And certainly I'd be remiss if I didn't thank them for their support of the project with a couple of fellowships in 2012 and 2013. Which allowed me to spend portions of a summer in Jerusalem writing chapters 1 and 2. So I'm very grateful for the CJS for supporting a lot of what I've done in the last few years. Okay. So as the title of the talk shows, today's talk will be on the Birkat Kohanim, or the so-called priestly blessing of Numbers 6, verses 24 through 26. The priestly blessing is one of the most well-known texts from the Bible due to its prominence in early Jewish and later Christian liturgy and literature. The blessing occupies a significant role in the literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls, rabbinic commentary, the Targumim, and other literature. But until very recently, we actually didn't know very much at all about the earliest history of the priestly blessing. That is, we didn't know very much about the blessing outside of the book of Numbers, where it appears in the Torah. So much of what I did in the book was really kind of an attempt to use my own training in Northwest Semitic inscriptions and early biblical literature to ask the question of what can we do with the corpus of Iron Age inscriptions in trying to understand the origins of the priestly blessing, and how can we better understand the reasons why certain expressions and words were chosen to be a part of the priestly blessing. So what I'd like to do today is to share a little bit of the research that I did for the book, but I'd also like to move beyond what I did in the book and I don't know, talk a little bit about where my thinking has gone in the past year. I suppose in kind of reflecting back upon what I did in the book, you write the book, and then you kind of figure out what you should have said in certain places in the book. And so you might think of today's talk as a little bit of a reflection upon some of the things that I wish I would have said in the book, and some of those will be forthcoming in an article in the Journal of Jewish Studies later this year as well. In 1979, archaeologist Gabi Bar-Chai and a grad student at the Institute for Holy Land Studies, Judith Hadley, discovered two tiny silver amulets in a tomb at the site of Ketef Hinnom. I'm sorry, the slide seems a little washed out. It's all right. At the site of Ketef Hinnom in Jerusalem. The tomb was part of a larger mortuary complex that was discovered under St. Andrew's Church on the western shoulder of the Hinnom Valley, right at the beginning of, or the intersection of the Hinnom Valley and the Rephaim Valley. You see here in the map, so there's Ketef Hinnom. As you see on the map, the location of the tomb where these amulets were found lies just southwest of the old city of Jerusalem, across from Hebron Road. Bar-Chai and Hadley discovered the amulets as they were cleaning the floor of a tomb repository. And as they were cleaning the floor of this tomb repository, here you see a picture of the repository, they discovered about 1,000 other objects together with the amulets that I'll talk about here in a minute. Presumably, the amulets had been buried with the dead in the primary part of the tomb, right on the so-called bench area of the tomb. And then they had been placed with the bones that had been gathered are placed in the tomb repository just below the bench chamber right here. Okay. The amulets were made of very thin sheets of silver foil, which were rolled up and placed on a chain to be worn around the neck. Both amulets had a small hole punctured at the top of the metal, indicating that they were suspended from a neck and worn like a necklace. At first, attempts to unroll the metal amulets failed, and here you see a shot of what they looked like before they were unrolled. It took about 3 years for the Israel Museum and other experts in Jerusalem to figure out a solution to how to unroll the amulets without damaging them significantly, but think about 1982, 1983, they were successful in finding some liquid potion that allowed them to unroll the amulets and provide us with what you see here on the screen. When the amulets were unrolled, they discovered that each amulet contained several lines of Paleo-Hebrew text that included versions of the priestly blessing. And I think that that's an important point to emphasize, that these amulets contain an abbreviated version of the blessing, not the entire blessing as we have it in Numbers chapter 6. So it would be a mistake to say we have the same exact text that we have in the book of Numbers on the amulets. Amulet 1, which is shown here on the left, contains 18 lines of Hebrew text, the last five of which preserve an abbreviated form of the priestly blessing. Amulet 2, also shown here on the right, contains a much shorter inscription, only 12 lines, with the priestly blessing taking up the last 8 lines right here. Although early studies of the amulets were able to show that the inscriptions did indeed have a version of the priestly blessing on them, the poor state in which the objects were preserved greatly impaired reading some of the other inscriptions on their surfaces. And I should add that seeing the inscriptions on the amulets on the screen, it gives one a sense that these were inscriptions that could actually be read. But the reality is that the size of these amulets makes it such that you cannot even see the inscriptions on their surfaces with the naked eye. So this is, the shots here are greatly enhancing our ability to read them. In 2004, the West Semitic Research Project at USC provided new high-res photographs of the inscriptions, and this is what we actually see on the screen right here. These photographs ultimately led to improved readings of the inscriptions, substantiating some of the earlier readings, as well as clarifying some of the more difficult parts of the text. Perhaps most importantly, arguably, the new reading showed that both amulets contained references to evil, thereby clarifying the inscriptions had an explicit apotropaic or protective force. For instance, as you see here in the slide, Amulet 1 refers to the Israelite God as more powerful than evil. Here I'm referring to the expression in lines 9 through 10, where the amulet refers to the blessing that the deity gives is more powerful than any snare or evil. In addition, the new readings of the inscriptions verified that the amulets also contained parallels to verses from the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Nehemiah. The excavator, Gabi Barkai, dated the amulets to the 8th and 7th centuries, and a lot of the subsequent discussion of them has really revolved around the question of the date. But the paleography of the inscriptions, I would say, ultimately, I think, verifies Barkai's dating of the inscriptions to the late pre-exilic period. That is, the Hebrew on the inscriptions most closely bears similarities to Hebrew inscriptions that we have dating to the 8th and the 7th and the 6th centuries B.C. This means that the amulets predate the biblical Dead Sea Scrolls by several hundred years, meaning that the inscriptions constitute the sole text that shows affinity to the biblical text before the Babylonian exile. The amulets, as I will emphasize a bit later in the talk, and I think this is something that is less emphasized in the secondary literature, is that it was really important to write out the blessing, not just to speak or recite the blessing in its earliest history. So much of what I did in the book to kind of segue here to what I'll do in most of the talk is what I did in the book is kind of tease out the importance of the amulets. How do they help us understand the function that the blessing held in its earliest history? Why were they located in a funerary context? What was the significance of placing the blessing in a tomb? Can we say that they function to protect the dead in some way, as we know is part of the later understanding of the blessing in rabbinic and later literature? What I would like to do in the course of today's talk, however, is to talk a little bit less about the context of the amulets in the tomb and a bit more about the priestly blessing in the Book of Numbers. The location of the priestly blessing on the amulets problematizes the blessing in the biblical text. In the Book of Numbers, the blessing is not connected to a funerary context, nor is it explicitly directed toward concerns over protection against evil. In this way, I think it's important to observe that the biblical text offers a strikingly different use or memory of this blessing. All right, it raises the question of whether we should really even be calling the blessing on the amulets the priestly blessing, indeed. Perhaps most notably, the text of Numbers, as I'm sure many are aware, associates the blessing with the priesthood and the tabernacle, hence the label priestly blessing. In this way, the text of Numbers creates an important connection between the duties that the priests carried out at the tabernacle or the temple. I guess to be a bit more specific, as you see on the slide, the Book of Numbers places the priestly blessing among several laws that detail the roles that the priesthood took on at the entrance of the tabernacle. You'll recall that the tabernacle is the mobile temple, the precursor to Solomon's temple described in 1 Kings. Within this context in the Book of Numbers, the author wrote the priestly blessing in the context of laws that describe the ritual for the suspected adulteress, or the sotah ritual, the law of the Nazarite in 6:1 through 21, and the dedication of the altar by the tribal leaders of Israel. The law of the Nazarite, as you may recall, instructs the Nazarite to return to the tabernacle, bringing offerings to the priests so that they may be offered on the altar. The law emphasizes that the rituals that both the priest and the Nazarite undertake should occur at the entrance of the tabernacle, or what the author of Numbers calls the tent of meeting. On the other side of the priestly blessing in the Book of Numbers, as you see here below in chapter 7, we have the description of the dedication of the tabernacle altar. This chapter details all of the items that the tribal leaders brought to the courtyard of the tabernacle. As this brief introduction to Numbers 5 through 7 shows, the priestly blessing was placed within a set of texts that describes the space of the tabernacle courtyard and the bringing of the votive and the bringing of votive and dedicatory offerings to the altar therein. Needless to say, both ancient and modern commentators have expended considerable energy trying to explain why the blessing was placed in this location in Numbers. As a result, when you read the commentaries, the commentators, scholars offer quite a wide variety of discussion and opinion over why we have the priestly blessing located here in Numbers. So the question about the blessing that I would like to spend a bit of time talking about today in the colloquium, it might actually seem like a simple one, but I think it's one that the amulets kind of forces us to reevaluate a little bit. Why do we have the priestly blessing in the Book of Numbers? And even more, why was the priestly blessing written within the tabernacle text of the Torah? That is, why did the biblical writers associate the blessing with the temple? Now, my sense is that one might assume a simple answer to this because we call it the priestly blessing, right? But this kind of reasoning becomes a bit circular, I think. The reason why we call it the priestly blessing is because the author of Numbers associated it with the temple. Based upon the discovery of the blessing on the two amulets, we might have expected, might have expected to find more allusions to the blessing in, say, the Psalms, where we find very striking sort of descriptions of prayers for protection against evil. That is, we might not have expected it to be aligned with the temple if we only had the evidence of the amulets. Now, my sense after writing the book on the blessing is that these questions are seldom asked or given serious attention due to the enormity of the importance that the blessing came to hold in early Jewish traditions. That is, scholars rarely spend time asking about the motivations that stood behind the inclusion of the blessing in the laws of the Torah because of the weighty afterlife that the blessing holds in post-biblical commentary and practice. For instance, as is well known, the blessing becomes one of the main remnants of priestly ritual following the destruction of the Second Temple and the cessation of sacrifice. We now know, in addition, that the priestly blessing held a very significant role in the Dead Sea Scroll literature, for example, showing that the importance of the blessing in early Jewish literature predates the attention it receives in rabbinic commentary. When scholars do ask this question, the answer usually runs along the lines of the following. And here I'll do my best and hopefully not overgeneralizing, but caricaturize a little bit of, I think, the way that commentators, both ancient and modern, kind of answer this question. The writing of the priestly blessing in the Torah was a reflection of the centrality that it held in the liturgy of the temples. That is, rabbinic and modern commentators tend to explain its presence as a written text by recourse to its oral performance in the temple. In short, the blessing preserves the memory of the temple. But this explanation, I would argue, tends to read the blessings later, or if we imagine the Book of Numbers in the Second Temple period, even contemporaneous liturgical function, back into the text of Numbers. Given the great difficulty that we have in dating the biblical text, and I might say especially the Book of Numbers, this explanation requires some reevaluation. Even more, what I've been stressing here is that you really should use the evidence of the amulets to problematize and encourage us to rethink the motivations that stood behind the blessing's association with the temple. Now, let me clarify. I don't necessarily think that there's any reason to doubt that the blessing held a central role in the liturgy of the temples. But assuming this from the beginning creates a bit of a problem in my thinking. And I'll explain this as we move on here. To start, explaining the presence of the blessing in Numbers as a reflection of an oral performance does not take the significance of the writing of the blessing seriously. What I mean here is that it does not start with a concern over why it was important to have the blessing as a physical, tangible object within the text of the Torah. That is, why was it important to preserve it in writing, and why was it placed in this particular legal corpus in the Book of Numbers? Right? Given that we have the blessing preserved in written form on the two amulets, we would do well to ask what was significant about the practice of writing blessings on various materials, whether they be amulets, tomb walls, or, in the case of Numbers, biblical texts. That is, I think to a certain extent we should be drawn first to ask why it was important to have the blessing in written form. So, and I think herein then it becomes the opportunity for us to look at what we can do with the corpus of written inscriptions that we have from the Iron Age. This isn't to diminish the importance that the oral recitation of the blessing held, but to push us to take seriously the importance of its placement as a text in the laws of Numbers. The benefit of this line of inquiry, as I hope to show in a few minutes, is that it actually resolves part of the problem that commentators have wrestled with regarding the blessing's location in the legal material of the Torah. If I could just briefly comment here, and I'll reduce this a bit, I think it's important to also recognize, and this isn't something that a lot of the secondary literature does sufficiently, I think it's also important to recognize here that source criticism really fails miserably in its effort to understand like the derivation, the origins of the blessing. Modern commentators will very frequently describe the priestly blessing as part of the priestly source of the Torah, but most honest commentators rather quickly admit that the priestly blessing really does not have most of the traits, the literary characteristics that we expect in the priestly literature of the Torah. Just one example here before we move on. The verb chanan, be gracious, in the blessing does not appear in a single other place in the priestly literature of the Torah. So the priestly blessing is seen as an independent text that was placed in the priestly literature describing the tabernacle. So again, then, if it doesn't fit the style of the priestly source, how and why did it become a part of it? Now, I think that the issues that I'm raising here about the blessing highlight a fundamental problem in the way that scholars have approached the study of the blessing, its origins, and its presence in the biblical literature. When I first began writing the book, I set out to write, and a few of my colleagues can attest to this, I set out to write what I would have called at the time an interbiblical interpretation of the blessing. That is, I kind of imagined that I would be writing an expansion upon Michael Fishbane's classic article on the priestly blessing, the form and reformulation of the priestly blessing in the Journal of the American Oriental Society. The more that I tried to work with Fishbane's article and the arguments that he makes therein, with all due respect, the more I came to realize that the blessing is actually quite rare in the biblical literature. That is, I wasn't finding obvious parallels to the blessing in the Bible. Time doesn't allow a full explanation of this. I guess you'll have to trust me to a certain extent here. But I guess what I'm getting at is that the priestly blessing didn't look all that biblical. Okay? To clarify, yes, we can find words that are used in the blessing frequently everywhere, right, in the Tanakh. But when we try to find the use of those words in the syntactic combination that we have in the blessing elsewhere in the Bible, we don't find them very much anywhere, to be quite frank. If one wants to find good parallels to the priestly blessing, and here I'm talking about very specifically the first line of the blessing where we have the verbs bless and guard or bless and keep paired, one actually has to go to the corpus of Iron Age inscriptions, not the biblical literature, interestingly enough. That is, we don't have a single other place in the Hebrew Bible where bless and guard are used in internal parallelism outside of Numbers 6:24. Okay? Remarkably so. I actually was rather surprised by that, looking in the rest of the corpus of poetry in the Hebrew Bible. So that is, the blessing's formulation, particularly the first line, is quite rare in the biblical text, but quite at home in the world of Iron Age Levantine inscriptions. So we're back to our original question. Why do we have the priestly blessing written in the text of Numbers? And even more, why was the priestly blessing placed within the tabernacle text in the Torah, adjacent to the law of the Nazarite and the description of the dedication of the altar of the temple? In the remaining minutes, I'd like to introduce two inscriptions that contain parallels to the priestly blessing. And we don't have time to work through all of them here today. But I think that these inscriptions are important because I think that they offer us a window, maybe a slightly different window into the way that we can think about the logic of the legal material in Numbers and the priestly blessing within it. My point is this, before I introduce the inscriptions. I think in order to understand the reasons why the priestly blessing was written in the Torah, I think that we should do two things. First, we need to look closer at the context, that is, the ritual spaces in which written blessings appear in the biblical period, whether they be tombs, temples, or other types of contexts. I'm not only interested in the inscriptions because they contain lexical parallels to the blessing, as we'll see here in a minute, but because they attest to the importance of using written blessings in specific ritual spaces during the biblical period. So let me start with the blessing inscription that might say represents one of the closest parallels to the priestly blessing, albeit it's not something that I would overstate. It's a minor parallel. But this blessing inscription, I think, is close to the date of the Ketef and Om amulets, and it's rather geographically close to the city of Jerusalem. So the inscription is relevant here because of its geography and its date. The inscription I'm referring to is known as the Ekron inscription. And you see, on the slide, a shot of the site of Ekron, which is located 35 kilometers west of Jerusalem. Ekron, you might recall, is one of the five cities of the Philistines in the biblical literature. Right? And it's located on kind of the border between the lowlands of Judah and the coastal plain. The site of Ekron was excavated over the course of 13 years in the late 80s and early to mid 1990s. During the summer of 1996, excavators discovered a large limestone inscription on the floor of the main temple of the city of Ekron, Temple Complex 650. The inscription, which you see here in the upper left, had originally been set into the interior of the western wall of the temple near what the excavators called the focal point of the inner chamber of the temple. The context in which the inscription was discovered led the excavators to date it to the 7th century, perhaps just before Nebuchadnezzar's campaign to Philistia in 603. But like the biblical priestly blessing, this blessing inscription is associated with a temple, as it offers a different context than what we have for Ketef Enom. The inscription itself was written on a block of limestone similar to the blocks used in the temple's construction. It should be noted here that the room in which the inscription was found also included ceramic vessels, several iron and gold objects, and a bronze scepter. In addition, in an adjacent, maybe storage area of the temple, the excavators also found 6 dedicatory jars, each one inscribed with the word holy on their surfaces. The inscription itself is divided into 5 lines of text. Right? The inscription begins with a standard dedicatory formula stating that the king of the city had built the temple. So here you see the translation of the inscription next to the drawing. The most relevant part of the inscription for us here today is found in lines 3 through 5, where we have very close parallel to the priestly blessing, where the inscription invokes a petition for the goddess of the city of Ekron to bless and guard, or bless and keep, however you want to translate Shamar, the king of the city prolong his days and bless his land. But what I would emphasize here more than the lexical parallels, and I think that again, like the lexical parallels are not exact, beyond just the pairing of those two verbs. So otherwise, we might say they're not all that significant. But what I would emphasize is that the context of the Ekron inscription is rather interesting. The inscription attests to a tradition of writing and displaying written blessings within temples in the Iron Age Levant. That is, the inscription forms an important part of the decor of the Temple of Ekron. The very size of the inscription, together with its location within the temple complex of the city, points to its physical and visual significance within the building. The inscription weighs 100 kilograms and is 60 by 39 by 26 centimeters. I don't have to go into all the details. that is, even though it's rather large, it's actually not enormous compared to other monumental inscriptions that we have further north. But its size and its placement within the temple indicates that it was important to have a written form of the blessing as part of the material itself that formed part of the construction of the temple. Moreover, the written blessing at Ekron functioned in that space as a memorial to the dedication of the building by the king of the city. Right? So it's not surprising, but I think it's really important to highlight that this is a blessing that is used within a royal dedicatory genre in the temple at Ekron. The presence of an inscribed blessing within a temple complex is not unique in the Iron Age Levant. The Ekron inscription betrays similarities to several other dedicatory blessing inscriptions, if we can call them that, discovered in Syria and Phoenicia. Most notably, the Ekron inscription resembles the content of an inscription discovered at the site of Byblos along the Lebanese coast, shown here on the slide. This is the so-called Yehamilic inscription of the 5th century, not to be confused with the sometimes better known inscription by biblicists, Yehimelech Biblos inscription of the 10th century. So the inscription you see on the screen up here dates to the 5th century BC. The inscription was commissioned by the king of the city of Biblos to be displayed in the courtyard of the temple of the goddess of the city. And it measures much larger than the Ekron inscription, 130 centimeters by 56 centimeters. The inscription is also much longer than the Ekron inscription, consisting of 15 as opposed to 5 lines, but also containing several parallels to the text of the priestly blessing. Here you see translation of just a portion of the inscription. Similar to the Ekron inscription, the Biblos inscription begins by identifying the king of the city of Biblos as the one who constructed the temple. Thereafter, the inscription describes several cultic items that the king of the city dedicated to the temple. That is, the physical, tangible stuff that the king donated and brought to the courtyard of the temple. To be specific, the inscription states that the king made an altar of bronze and a winged solar disk, which was set into the blessing scene at the top of the step. Right here. Thereafter, the inscription states that the goddess of Biblos heard the king's plea and gave him peace. The last few lines of the inscription contain a blessing requesting that the goddess of the city bless the king and prolong his days. Right? So again, I think it's important to emphasize that the Biblos inscription does not contain a close parallel to the priestly blessing. It does echo some of its verbs. Some of its language is paralleled in Numbers 6. But what I would emphasize here again is that it's not so much the lexical parallels that are helpful, but I think the way in which the inscription attest to, again, the tradition of writing and displaying written blessings within temples. The inscription draws attention to the importance of installing blessings as physical, tangible objects, and in the case of the Biblos inscription, ones that have a text and an image, within the ritual space of a temple in the Iron Age. Moreover, the inscription explicitly connects the description of a divine blessing to the construction of the bronze altar and the completion of the temple of the goddess of Biblos. That is, both the placement of the inscription in the temple and the content of the inscription itself draws spatial connections between written blessings, or inscribed blessings, and the altar of the deity and the dedication of the temple. In this way, the text of the Biblos inscription is a microcosm of sorts of the spatial layout of the courtyard of the temple of the city. And I'll move along here a bit. So how might these inscriptions reorient the way in which we view the significance of the priestly blessing in Numbers? Hopefully this will stimulate a little bit of discussion here in a few minutes. Even more, how might the location of these inscriptions in their respective temples clarify why the author of Numbers placed the priestly blessing in the tabernacle text? Hopefully what I'm going to conclude here is beginning to take shape. That is, I think that the inscriptions from Ekron and Biblos, their place in temple contexts, provide a partial answer to these questions. The inscriptions, I would argue, cast light on what we might call the spatial logic of the priestly blessing in Numbers. You'll recall, as I described at the beginning of the talk, that the priestly blessing in the book of Numbers was located between a law that described a Nazirite bringing votive offerings to the courtyard of the tabernacle, and between a text that describes the tribal leaders of Israel bringing dedicatory offerings to the courtyard of the tabernacle. In other words, the chapters that surround the priestly blessing in the book of Numbers look a lot like an archive of sorts of the different types of artifacts that one might expect to find in Levantine temples, in temples in Syria and Phoenicia and and the Southern Levant. That is altars, votive offerings, and we might say inscriptions with written blessings on them. In a similar way, we might see the writing of the blessing in the space of Numbers as an appropriation and adaptation of the practice of placing written blessings in Iron Age temples. Right? So again here, the focus upon the importance of having a written blessing in the text. I might suggest that one way to approach the spatial logic of Numbers is to imagine the author adapting the practice of placing written blessings in temples by writing the blessing in the space of a text that describes a temple. In this way, I think it is also important to note here, for purpose of contrast, that we actually have a lot of descriptions of important characters in Tanakh issuing blessings. I mean, Moses, Exodus 39, Aaron, Leviticus 9, Solomon, 1 Kings 9. But we really don't have many places in the Tanakh where we have the text of a blessing that's given written out in full. Maybe save 1 Kings chapter 9 with Solomon's dedicatory prayer. In Numbers, the blessing has been written out in full and displayed as part of the space of the textual description of the tabernacle. We don't have a description of a person giving the blessing, although the text of Numbers describes it or frames it as instruction from Sinai to the priests. But rather, we have a blessing set in the book and framed as divine instruction to the sons of Aaron. The location of the written blessings at Ekron and Byblos and temples, I think, pushes us to ask a bit more of how we might understand the literary logic of Numbers as well. The Byblos inscription stood next to the altar in the temple courtyard, and its text connected the deity's blessing to the dedication of the altar. Viewed against the background of the place that blessings held in such ritual spaces, the motivations behind the priestly blessing's location in Numbers becomes a bit clearer. The text of Numbers 1 through 10 reflects an attempt to map spatially the location and material relationship between blessings, altars, the entrance of the tabernacle, and dedicatory festivities. The author of Numbers placed the blessing in this space in order to convey its physical connection to altars and temple dedications. I think, incidentally, it's interesting to note that a lot of rabbinic commentary, later Jewish commentary, also deals quite a bit with the question of, like, where should the priestly blessing be performed? In the synagogue or in the temple. Okay. By writing and displaying the priestly blessing in this context, the author of Numbers also made a material statement. It is not only important to stress that the text of the priestly blessing reflected something, but also to ponder how the very textualization of the blessing held meaning. The inscriptions at Ekron and Byblos intended to make a statement about the tangibility of the blessings of their respective gods. That is, the blessing inscriptions served to give emphasis to the power of the king, the wealth of the city, and the physicality of the temple. The materiality of the inscriptions stressed the permanence, the enduring quality of the deity's blessing. The blessing was there, set physically in a place. This line of thought, I might conclude, presses us, I think, to take the materiality of the text of Numbers more seriously. That is, the text's significance as an object and a space, and its production in the way that we think about the composition of biblical literature. Scholars who work with inscriptions often use them to inform diachronic conclusions or to illuminate the assumed world behind the text. These are important questions, of course, but we might also ask how such inscriptions might be used to deconstruct and reconstruct our notion of text and help us relocate the relationship between text and ritual and think about the motivations behind the way that authors spatially map stuff in the biblical literature. Here I am thinking that it's helpful to suggest that it was not just the memory of the temple that paved the way for or motivated the author of Numbers to write the priestly blessing in the laws of Torah. Rather, the writing of the blessing in the text of the Torah relocated its perceived ritual authority to a new realm, a textual realm, a realm in which its ritual performance could be given more enduring expression than on stone in a temple. The placement of the blessing in this textual realm served to transfer its material and performative significance to the realm of the interaction between a text and a community. Those who heard the reading of the blessing identified with the descriptions of the persons in the text who approached the tabernacle with offerings expecting to receive divine blessing. In this way, the author of Numbers not only found a more enduring or portable location in which to set the written blessing, but also paved the way for its use in the ritual reading of the text. For the author of Numbers, the temple was textual, or the tabernacle was textual, and they wrote the blessing within the space of a text instead of the space of a temple. Thank you.
Open it up for some discussion.
Person, right?
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. I have one question and one suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the paleographic nature of the inscription, which you say strongly suggests that it's pre-exilic. Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that some of the Dead Sea Scrolls use the paleographic script? And in fact, I know that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe also more than that, that some very late texts use the paleographic script to write the name of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's great, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
So it would seem to me that the paleographic nature of the script, of the amulet, isn't probative. I'd like to address that.
Just to respond quickly to that one, I think that is a fair critique. But I would say that the combination of its location in the tomb and the fact that really the paleography of these inscriptions pretty remarkable match to things like the Lachish letters and the Gibeon jar handles. I mean, not just one corpus of Iron Age inscriptions from the 8th and the 7th centuries, but quite a variety of inscriptions that we can compare with the paleography of the amulets. And so, I think it's fair to say that, you know, scribes in the late Second Temple period are able to maybe imitate or emulate some of the Paleo-Hebrew, okay, but I really don't think that is something that really shakes the foundation at all.
It does raise the question, you must admit.
I think you're giving too much ground here to Gershon. I would say that...
Jeffrey's giving too much ground?
Yeah, Jeremy's giving too much ground here. I would say in the Dead Sea Scrolls you have Paleo-Hebrew imitations, but there are developments in the Paleo-Hebrew script that are used in the Dead Sea Scrolls. For example, Paleo-Leviticus is not the same script as this. So it's a slightly different version, archaizing version. This script maps to the Iron Age perfectly. And, of course, the archaeology of the context of the inscription makes it really undeniable. But I don't think that even the paleography is that questionable. It reminds me of the kind of argument of the dating of the Siloam inscription that became so infamous a while back. I mean, yeah, there are some similarities, and they did revive the archaic script.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is a, and you're right, it is a problem. It's problematic because they're so small that. But I don't know. I wouldn't have given in on that one, but you're more generous than
me. Well, if I may add something to this question as an Egyptologist, I mean, from Egypt, of course, we have a much larger corpus of textual amulets. It's about 100. And then we can see that this format of these amulets, which I call the Tosh, the narrow format, was en vogue in Egypt between the 10th and the 8th century BCE and was replaced by a broad format in the 7th century. And so, and this tall format was never taken away. And so that suggests that if this comes from Egypt, which I strongly believe, not directly, but from it is a model that was used in Egypt between the 10th and the 8th century only. And so that would also argue for a rather early date of these things rather than Hellenistic.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that Yaakov has worked on the Egyptian side of this, and I think is very helpful in clarifying the date is more likely earlier.
Absolutely.
Than late Second Temple period, which, you know, I mean, there were a couple of scholars who wanted to argue that. I mean, I just think that it's, you know.
I mean, it's fair. I mean, Renz, in his you know, German compendium on these inscriptions, dated them to the Hellenistic period. And so there's, like, I would say out in the literature, there is a strong question because of that, I would say, incorrect analysis that is part of the reference works. But I think the more recent work on them, including Jeremy's work, sort of confirms a much earlier date.
There was the suggestion I wanted the other
time. Oh, yes.
Sorry. And it was this, that the dedication of the tabernacle, which 71 to 89, is problematic because it's so boring, isn't it? Everybody gives the same gift. I mean, you know, it's really one of the ostensibly weakest parts of the whole of the Torah because of that repetition. The commentators give their various explanations for this, but it seems to me that your study, your investigation, and your thing provides a new explanation for the identical gifts, because they are not merely gifts, and they don't merely show the equal power, the equal importance of all the 12 tribes, which is the traditional explanation. It is necessary for all the 12 tribes to give identical gifts because the dedication of the temple must be done equally by all the children of Israel. And I think that emerges from your study.
Thank you. Yeah, and I should be a bit honest too and say that, you know, part of my thinking in that direction was influenced by Baruch Levine's article of 1963, where he showed that, I think quite convincingly, that the material in chapter 7 of Numbers, the syntax and the numbers very closely matches archival, you know, dedicatory style of these archival lists from the Iron Age and in ancient Near East. So I was nudged greatly by Levine's work. Sarah.
Thank you. I'm not a biblical scholar, as you know, and I'm sort of following Yaakov's footsteps, because the amulets are also taken up in the Greek tradition in the early Iron Age. And so I have an amuletic question, but I'd like to get back to the large inscriptions. I think it's brilliant the way you've mapped out this ritual space. How does it get transferred in the text? The language of those inscriptions is very much contractual, right? Between a ruler and the deity. As we know, part of Hebrew, Greek religion, I'm doing this for you, and you're going to do this in return. And the Greeks pick up only the charis part, the favor. They don't ask for the blessing. So that happened, that's clear in part of this sort of the king as the representative of the god. But when you get to the amulets, it's private, right? It's a family member asking for a blessing and not promising anything in return, correct? That is,
yeah.
And there's the speaking and the making. So that's a sort of whole ritual space that's mostly private, because the deity can be named, but there's no ruler representative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the person asking for a blessing in an amulet is promising something in return. Or do I just not know the corpus?
The first amulet, it does evoke, I think, notions of the covenant that are paralleled in the book of Deuteronomy, where you do feel like there's this more of a sense of contractual obligation,
so
right? So like, you know, he's the one who guards the ones who keep the cup, you know. I mean, that seems to be evident in Amulet 1, that you have these overtones to, like, the rhetoric of Deuteronomy, where I would say, then it does kind of seem like it is a bit contractual, at least in the first amulet. The second amulet, there's none of that language. The smaller one doesn't have that.
So it just, in general, because we're in the context of a contractual religion, that can be assumed. But when someone's asking for a blessing, it's not going to be delivered by a priest is going to be delivered by the effect of the amulet, mm-hmm. right? And it's not going to be delivered by a god. So it seems as almost there are three different contexts for this. And I'm fascinated to see how you work that this then works back into the text in a very different way. We have to think about that. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, please.
I can see where when you make the question, why is this blessing in the place where it is in the Book of Numbers, you can reason to your conclusion. But does that have anything to do with where it was found? This amulet was found. It wasn't found in a temple. Mm-hmm. It was found in a burial chamber, and it's part of an amulet. So it's something that people wore either during their life and they were buried with it, or it was put on for when they died. It sounds, if you start there, it sounds like this is kind of a prototypical St. Christopher's medal, something that somebody wore that ward off evil. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't it that?
I think that it's important to emphasize that even though we find the amulet in a tomb context, that this would have been, you know, part of the valuable possessions of the person in life. And so I'm not so sure that, I mean, on the one hand, like here in the talk, I've definitely emphasized that numbers and the amulets represent a very striking different, like contrast in a way. Yet at the same time, as I think through, you know, my argument of like, okay, you know, you have these written blessings, I want to also go, wait a minute here. In the biblical Sotah, Numbers 5, and in fact, you might even just stretch that and say, like, Numbers 5 and 6, these are legal texts that deal with priests, you know, and these legal texts mainly revolve around situations where a person comes to the entrance of the tabernacle and the priest does something. Right, in the case of Numbers 5, the really intriguing, you know, part of that text for the amulets is, of course, that in Numbers 5, the priest is depicted as writing curses upon materials carry out the rituals for the suspected adulteress. So I think that we're in the realm of Numbers 5 through 7 where the priestly blessing may be mapped here because of its, you know, the location where written blessings were placed in temple courtyards, but also because Numbers 5 and 6 depict the priests as ritual specialists who are doing certain things that don't fit, right? Let's say Leviticus 1 through 10 with the description of the sacrificial rituals. It's sort of like a, you know, Milgram liked to call it the, you know, miscellaneous category of what the priest did as specialists. And in Numbers 5 and 6 also has this reflex of, like, you know, the priests are reciting something orally, you know, and they're also writing things down. Well, that's intriguing too. Because even though we emphasize the burial context of the amulets, whoever had these, you know, probably got them from a ritual specialist, or certainly got them from a ritual specialist, and maybe one attached to the temple, priest. I'm tempted to say, and I think that I would in part be borrowing a little bit of what Milgram has already said in this in his commentary on Numbers, that we're not surprised to find the amulets at all in a way, because they fit sort of the characterization of the priests in Numbers 5 and 6 as ritual specialists who write things upon various materials, and that these amulets would have been given to those who were buried in the tomb, and they wore them as valuable possessions in life to protect them against various evils.
But priests didn't have anything to do with funerals or burials or dead bodies, did they?
Sure.
They were supposed to stay away from them, weren't they? Because they were unclean.
No, I mean, they're allowed to be involved. I mean, they're sanctioned to be involved. So, but I mean, I don't know that necessarily is something that's present in Numbers 5 through 6 at all. I mean, that's not the concern here isn't with burial of the dead. The concern here is just with giving the person an amulet that they can wear, right? That's not, I wouldn't overemphasize that these were amulets that were made for the dead. They were made for people to wear when they were living. And they were just buried with the person as valuable possessions. Yeah?
Who was Our Lady of Byblos?
I'm sorry?
Who was Our Lady of Byblos? The reference.
The text of the inscription is a conundrum. She is identified, and some have identified her as Pythagaea. But the Gimel in the text is greatly damaged, and so the argument has revolved around whether or not we're really correctly reconstructing the text of that inscription. So,
I have a question. Given that there are other parts of the Torah where a narrative seems to suddenly get interrupted and another narrative comes in, is there any possibility that the blessing was not exactly intentional and logical in the setting of the other parts of Numbers 5 to 7, but was that a beginning of cut and paste kind of an approach, number one and number two? Given the great specificity and details about the tabernacle, would you have expected something more to say, this is a blessing that you should say and also inscribe at the tent of meeting, etc., etc.?
I think both those questions are actually fantastic questions, and I would say that, yeah, to a certain extent, I think we're looking at cut and paste. You know, that they're cutting and pasting different texts here in the legal material. But I don't think that it's surprising that they locate the blessing right next to a description of dedicatory offerings brought to the courtyard. And it, you know, on the one hand, you say, well, I mean, it's interesting that we can tease out the way in which that relates to ritual space on the ground. But, I mean, in a lot of other biblical texts, blessings are connected to dedications of things, right? So I don't think it's that big of a surprise. It maybe is helpful to map it out, you know, think about how we would understand its relationship to the space of a temple. And so certainly. Now, your second question, I think, is even more intriguing in a way, precisely because if you look at the instructions that we have for the blessing, you said, you know, would we expect to have something like, this is how you recite it and this is how you write it out? Well, maybe we do, right? I mean, if you look at the instructions that are given for the blessing in Numbers 6, 22 through 27, the first part of the instructions begin with a command to speak them or recite them. And then they are framed in verse 27 by, so they shall seem put my name on the Israelites. Now, the question is, of course, with the Hebrew verb that's used there is, what exactly is the connotation? And most commentators really struggle with that. You know, what is the connotation of seem to put the blessing on, or put my name on the Israelites? What does that convey? As you know, seem can be translated a variety of ways, but what exactly does that convey here? Jacob Milgram, in his commentary, liked to sort of like suggest that seem here quite literally is a reflection of what we have with the amulets, right? That to put them on, right, is to write it out and wear the blessing as an amulet. Seems convenient, but maybe you could do probably better with the syntactic combination of seem plus the preposition all in these texts. Is very frequently used in the Torah to describe the practice of putting necklaces and other headdress on people. To put something on, seem all, is to wear a cordon, a necklace, or put things on the head.
Yeah, but I also ask one more small thing.
Yeah.
How do you think it was contemporaneously or in ancient Israel religion understood the Lord make his face to shine upon you, when even Moses couldn't look at God's face? What is that a good translation from whatever the Hebrew word, or is it radiance or aura or?
No, it's a very good translation of the term, and I would say that this part of the priestly blessing is purposefully drawing upon the very frequent allusions to the face of the deity in the Psalms. Right? And most of the reason why the Psalms do that, you know, may the Lord, you know, shine or make his face shine. It's an interesting question. My guess would be, and I think that there's good reason to think that, is that this part of the blessing centralizes the blessing around the city of Jerusalem. Read together with the Psalms, you know, the Psalms are replete with this idea. A pilgrim is traveling to Jerusalem, and you request the deity to have his face beam out, you know, to the pilgrim and provide safe passage to the city of Jerusalem. It's an expression of protection and deliverance, but within the Psalter, right, with the connotation of making a pilgrimage to the city.
You know, the other main idiom in the Psalter is histirpanim, which mm-hmm. is to hide your... God hides his face from you. So, I mean, this is the flip side, and that occurred multiple times in Psalms. So if God's blessing, God, you know, you're not being blessed by God, God is hiding his face from you. And if God is blessing you, he's shining his face upon you. I think it's like mm-hmm. flip sides of the same...
The antithesis of,
yeah,
the,
of the same
yeah.
idea.
Yeah,
I was just wondering, in terms of that, you were saying about putting the amulet physically, simal, in that construction, might that be related to how priests were supposed to have an amulet somewhat upon their head mm-hmm. in relation, it said kedush lanonai, on their forehead, and that was somehow related to a priest would then put the name of, they had the name of the Lord on the forehead, they put the name of the Lord in an intercessory way on Israel, and then maybe somehow that's interconnected.
Well, I think you make a great point, and this is one of the things I point out, I think, Exodus 28, you know, verse 30, where you have this idea of, like, the priest seem all puts, you know, jewels or whatever on sort of the priestly vestments is a reflect, like, the language is related to that idea, right? So, seem all to put the name upon the Israelites, you know, how concrete we want to make it, I think it's another issue, but I'm not surprised that the text would be understood that way. Right, that there's a difference between what the text intended to say and the way that it was, you know, understood or read later on. We have many more examples of amulets with the priestly blessing on it later in early Jewish, in late antique Judaism. And so clearly, you know, the force of the command in verse 27 was understood precisely that way. That you put the blessing on. Your body on it is right.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
I have one historical question. So this place in Ekron, you mentioned, was a synagogue.
A temple.
A temple.
Yeah, okay.
A temple. And it had an altar. Was the altar the place of sacrifice? And the priests performed the sacrifice just at the temple in Jerusalem? Or what was the place of these satellite temples in ancient Judea?
It's a good question. With the temple at Ekron, it is actually the largest example of an Assyrian temple that we have in that region, the southern Levant. So a very different style of temple than, say, we have described in, you know, the passage describing Solomon's temple or the tabernacle. So the question of, like, you know, the Ekron temple is a question of the style of a non-Israelite temple. So the temple of Ekron that I alluded to is not Israelite. It is an Assyrian style, and so there I probably cannot say much more. We would have to leave that to, you know, the archaeologists of the site.
So you wouldn't know what the role of the priest was.
No, and I don't think that we know. I mean, I think that the temple at Ekron is very interesting in that it contains a lot of dedicatory materials found in situ, in the courtyard, and some of the storerooms in the temple, but what we can say about priestly duties, I don't know.
Well, one more question to
Sarah.
So I think some people were asking, as also with Biblos, these have nothing to do with Yahwism or Judaism. It's a Philistine city with a Neo-Assyrian maybe, and the Biblos set would be Phoenician.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's not, they don't, it's not the same religion as the Hebrew Bible, but these traditions, these inscriptions, these documents are very powerful in shaping how, presumably, this early period of Yahwism, they're writing out their own texts and their own beliefs. Is that what's...
Absolutely, and the monumentality of the inscriptions, I think, is very evocative for the way that the biblical writers probably would have thought. As I'm becoming more and more convinced that we're also looking at texts that are interested in preserving there's a recollection of a world here in the way that they're thinking about where you place things in a text that I think is just as important as the question of like how do we understand. These texts as trying to capture certain, rituals. Right?
So could there have been such monumental inscriptions in temples devoted at this period, or does that go into this very difficult problem about if and when there was even a temple in Jerusalem at this period?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to speculate about the Solomon's temple, whether we would have one. So we just don't know.
Well, thank you very much.